You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hello and welcome to Real Living. This is Lavinia Spirito with Mary Lou Nemecek, and we are continuing in our series on this really great book called True Leadership, put out by the Haberger Institute for Catholic Leadership at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota. I went to college with the guy who wrote this book. He's not credited because he's writing as part of the staff of the Institute for Leadership, but it's so typical him, philosophy history major, who went on to get PhDs, multiple areas, who's a priest. Just fantastic. Just I love the way he thinks, and I love the way he has just done all this work, and because he's so cutting and it's so precise, and yet sometimes he'll just let loose and say, y'all, that's just silly, you know, or that's gutless, or that's, you know, whatever. So we're talking about the importance of leadership, not only in the public square, but also in our families, in our ministries, in all our spheres of influence. This is our third show on this topic, and I suspect it's going to be a several shows.
Yes, indeed.
But it's so good that because as we were saying in other shows, the topic of leadership may seem like just an isolated topic for leaders, but actually it applies to all of us, because in order to be good followers, we need to be good leaders.
That's right. That's what's so remarkable about the book, is that it does apply to everyone. That's why we keep saying we want everyone to read this book.
We're going to continue. Leadership is a habit, a way of being, a quality that inheres in the personality, not a knack or a technique. It involves skills, but it is not mainly a skill. It is a fundamental human activity rooted in our creation and the likeness of God, which is why everyone has a measure of ability for leadership, right? True leadership is not so much what a person does, it's who a person is, which, you know, I don't know about you, but I'm just getting this Doppler effect with the political effect, you know, elections, and just talk about leadership out there. It's like it's the opposite of what we're seeing presented in candidates, for instance, for public office. Obviously, the presidential elections are heavy on everybody's minds, but it just does not seem to me that we are going to the polls to elect a person. We're going to the polls to elect a mercenary, you know, somebody who's going to do our bidding, and who cares if they have character or not.
Or we see the defects in leadership lately, and that what they say and what they do are two different things.
Well,
and we sense that.
And everything is utilitarian.
Exactly.
It's not really directed towards the dignity of the person, right?
And as we get a little bit further on, that comes up in this book, of that approach to life.
So true leadership comes from being a true disciple. I think he doesn't put it that way, but this is the way I would sum it up. True leadership is attained and possessed as an expression of a person's character. And it's interesting, because in a lot of elections and a lot of things, character really doesn't matter. You know, it's like, who cares what they lied? Who cares what they said? Who cares, right?
Their personal life is not a part of this, which is basically untrue. How a person lives their life and how they relate to others is an integral part of who you are.
Absolutely. I love the way he puts this. Those who use position of leadership to compensate for what they lack within themselves always make a hash of their leadership duties. Many people have children, but fewer are true fathers and mothers. Many attain positions of authority in business or politics or the church or civic life, but very few exercise true leadership. Everyone, and I think you and I know that, has had the miserable experience of suffering through the supposed leadership of a weak-charactered or unprincipled person, whose failures led to all manners of difficulties. Because leadership is rooted in the spiritual and moral being of the person, true leadership can only be attained slowly. And elsewhere he says, forget attending a life-changing weekend where they give you 10 principles for perfect leadership. That's just not going to work.
No.
Yeah, you can put them in your arsenal, but unless you are a mature spiritual person, and a person of high moral character, all those 10 principles aren't going to really amount to
anything. Well, this gave me great comfort, because you know how people take great notes and they go out and they're all fired up and they're going to go out and do this and that and the other. And honestly, you do see some real changes in people. But my experience usually is that slow path. I am the turtle and not the hare, you know? And it becomes very frustrating because you feel like, oh, gosh, I haven't really gotten it yet, or I haven't attained it, or I'm not there yet. But reading this, it is a process. And it's not something that you just grab and latch onto and you're done.
Characters forged in the inner being of the person. It is the fruit of long training, of seriously engaging the fight against self. Ooh. That's interesting, of wrestling with the many individual decisions and the challenge of life, all with the help of God. There is no shortcut, as you were saying, right?
This is like an examination of conscience and reading
exactly,
through this book.
Right? Mm-hmm. And you know, I thought that was interesting. He said, that's why family life is so important for the health of any human society and the proper training of leaders, because it is only in the family context that that whole cocktail of personal concern, training over a number of years, ties of affection and loyalty can be found. All other institutions mimic what the family accomplishes.
Exactly.
I thought that was very, very interesting. Other institutions such as schools and seminaries and summer camps share the duties, but they do so most effectively by imitating and building on family life, right? You want to have small groups. Why? Because you want to grow.
And what is being destroyed these days is the family.
That's right. So that's it's assuming a particularly sinister, even further sinister character. The long process necessary to gain strong character also explains the reluctance of much of the leadership world to seriously tackle the challenge of true leadership, right? So true leadership is normally exercised in the context of common institutional life, which is true. I mean, you know, you can't really exercise leadership in a vacuum, although you could lead yourself, I suppose. But it's important that we see that there are common institutions. As Americans, people kind of rebel against that idea. Why do we have to belong to an institution? Why can't we do it all by ourselves? Why can't it just me and a couple of friends?
Well, in American life, we're supposed to be self-sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's one of the key words that people use in describing Americans.
Mm-hmm. And he goes into the whole concept of servant leadership. It's funny. We went to a Legatus meeting and somebody went, kept talking about servant leadership, but they weren't defining it. And my husband turns to me and says, What is servant leadership? Because it's like jargon. It's like a term that you hear in Catholic world, maybe. But you don't really, it's not, people know what it means, but who are in, but the other people, like regular folks, have absolutely no idea, right? So I think it's interesting to see that servant leadership means following the lead of Jesus. To be a servant leader means to serve others as Christ would according to the mind of God. And I like how he puts it here. It does not mean to be a butler leader who simply does the will of others. And yet it is really seeing what the Father has for a group of people and communicating that and leading it. And you can see this most clearly in parental leadership, like in the family. Parents don't go to their children and say, okay, anything you want me to do, we're doing it right now. No, right? Mm-hmm. But conversely, they also don't tell the children, hey, we're not doing anything of what you want, right? It's usually what? It's the parents and the children on the same pathway to God. And so the parents are saying, look, we have responsibilities towards God because you've been given to us and we need to train you and lead you up and love you and cherish you and serve you, but for your good, not just so that you will attain the latest gaming system, you know, without working for it.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
So I think that's interesting. We seldom serve our children by doing what they want them to do, right? We serve them as much by disciplining them as we do by granting their requests. I think that's really cool. You know, I think it's interesting to see that, like in other areas, the family models this idea of leading people towards the Lord and how we are responsible and as servant leaders to lead our children and our spouses towards the Lord. And they are responsible to lead themselves and us towards the Lord, right?
Well, and he makes that point that as with love, so with service, we are orientated first to God, then to others.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to have this put in the right order, first of all. And that once we have that in the right order, it's the two aspects of service, and they're not in conflict with each other.
Mm-hmm.
They complement each other. That's going back to that family unit. Mm-hmm. You know, where's our family? You know, we are sons and daughters of God, made in their image and likeness.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the integral part of our family resides.
Mm-hmm.
So everything should come from that. And it's a beautiful way of looking at things. It's difficult to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's a process. But how often do we think about that? And you know, that's like with marriage, you know, there are three people involved in the marriage, God and the husband and the wife. And the husband and wife make the vows with God present. It's not the priest.
Right.
So I think we kind of have to look at things that way. As in a marriage.
Well, the goal in Christian life is to get to heaven. And the goal of leadership should be leading people to heaven. And I guess to sum up this whole chapter, the main school of holiness is the family first.
Yes.
And that's why attacks against the family just are particularly sinister in this context, because if we don't get it right in the family, if we don't learn the family, we're going to be forever wounded. Not forever wounded, because God heals and God is gracious. But we are going to be approaching life maybe with a little bit less of an understanding, something we're going to have to work hard to gain in other settings, right? Now, the next thing that we're going to talk about is this idea of the good old days, and he calls it the utopian temptation. He says, since the Enlightenment, of course, that great intellectual movement that took place in the 17th century, we have kind of had a paradigm shift in what it means to live life and what it means to lead others. The leaders of the Enlightenment, they were taken just with the whole, you know, oh, we, you know, we have the steam engine and we have this and we have that, all the material and the technical achievements. And they looked forward to ever greater mastery of their physical environment through the progress of applied sciences. But what they did is they lost sight of the real nature of humanity's wound. They denied the fall and insisted that our real enemy was ignorance. And that's really true, because if you see, even in a certain way, large institutions like the United Nations, they think that if you could just eradicate poverty and ignorance, everybody will get along.
That's right.
But that takes... That's not a Christian point of view, although Christians do want to help the world to be a better place, and they do want to educate the ignorant. They do want to come alongside the people who are suffering, but with an understanding that we are all wounded by original sin and that humanity is fallen. That is a prerequisite for really understanding true leadership. We will be right back.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hi, and welcome back to Real Living. We are unpacking this book called True Leadership, put out by the Haberger Institute for Catholic Leadership at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota.
This is true speed reading as we go through this
book. It is.
We're trying to hit on the high points.
We're just trying, because that way if you go back to the book, you can see, hopefully, that we have hit some of the high points. I like this idea, this chapter on utopia, because it pinpoints really one of the essences of the modern progressive attitude, which is if we can just throw enough technology at things, if we can just throw enough education at things, people will be fine and people will change and there will be no war, you know, or no crime or no moral turpitude or whatever, you know, we'll be fine if we can just throw this, the amount of our knowledge and our applied sciences towards problems. Well, yeah.
This is man solving problems without any internal
precisely perspective.
God being present in it at all. And that's why it keeps failing.
And he says, the ideology of progress may be called the working religion of the modern age. You know, it's just... All is having to do with the fact that, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, there were people who lived and who fought and who died and who wrote great things and who studied. But somehow, as moderns, we're much better than them because we have technical prowess and technical achievements. And we are the beneficiaries of progress, whatever that is, air quotes around that word. And somehow that makes us better. And it kind of dispenses us from the moral requirements that our fathers and our mothers labored under. You know, I'm sure you've heard that, right? The Christian insistence on the reality of the fall and the impossibility of healing its effects apart from God was felt to be a pernicious doctrine that needed to be, that held humanity, basically the humanity in check, the whole idea of the Humanist Manifesto that you and I did some shows on.
Oh my gosh, it was such an eye-opener.
It was basically, we can discuss the whole point, and it was the first Humanist Manifesto written in 1933, largely noted by American educational thinker John Dewey. Put it this way, quote, "We can discover no divine purpose or providence for the human species. While there is much that we do not know, humans are responsible for what we are or what we will become. No deity will save us. We must save ourselves.
It's so scary to think that people buy into that. I can't identify with it. And there was another one written later, another humanist manifesto.
Two more.
Oh, two more?
Yeah, Humanist Manifesto 2 and 3.
Well, you can see the effect that it's had on our daily life, because this is exactly how governments and society and institutions are trying to conduct laws and, and education
and
everything.
We must save ourselves. That's
exactly
the whole point. There is salvation on a secular level without having to do recourse to God. And that is what he calls the utopian temptation, the idea that we can pull ourselves up by our bootstraps and everything will be fine, because really, you know, utopia is the first coined by St. Thomas More, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who defined it as, it was the Greek word for nowhere. Utopia is usually an ideal that is never attained.
Which
it's
is exactly
some
true.
Idyllic thing that's going to happen, but who knows if it's going to happen,
right?
What I thought was interesting was that morally and socially, most modern ideologies have a utopian core. If only we throw all our resources at it, then we'll be fine. Marxist communism is utopian. If only we just annihilate poverty, everything will be fine. Nationalist fascism is utopian. If only we could get everybody to belong to the same nation and the same ethnic group that we are, we won't have these problems, because ethnic conflict is a problem. The movement for sexual liberation is utopian. If only we can have sex unfettered sex with no consequences and no strings attached, then everybody will be fine. The green movement is utopian. If only we could just reduce our carbon footprint and annihilate the human scourge off the face of the earth and let the universe breathe, everything will be fine. Those who think science will solve all our problems are also utopians. Those who think American capitalist democracy is the answer to all the world's ills are utopians, because the answer to all the world's ills is Jesus Christ in the power of the Holy Spirit and in the Catholic Church.
That's right.
And that is such an incredibly unpopular thing to say that I kind of marvel at myself for saying it, because it's so beyond what common wisdom is.
But I think that it has kind of evolved into that. You know, I sent you something this week about the Capitol and all the places where God is mentioned in different places there. Yes. And so if you go and you look at some of the monuments, it's there. Where did we lose it? Mm-hmm. You know, that's the sad part of it.
Mm-hmm. So there it is. Whatever might be the genuine insights of these various ideologies, well, some of them were pretty, you know, Marxism, Leninism was responding to the oligarchical plutocracy, really, of the great families and the wealthy people at the end of the 17th and 18th centuries, for instance. So there was a response that needed to be made. It's just that they threw the baby out with the bathwater.
Well, you know, he says the truth is we all become utopians to some degree, and I agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all want that perfect scenario, that perfect environment, that, you know, where everything is the way it should be. And sadly, you know, I think when I think about in Germany, when Hitler came into power, he had this gift of, you know, his oratory of speeches and so forth just lifted people up to this, you know, perfect civilization and country and this, that, and the other. We have to recognize that we are all prone to buying into that. We have to be very careful.
Absolutely. Utopians deny a basic aspect of our reality, namely that the reason evil dominates the world is not because of poverty or because of technological backwardness. It's because individual humans are captured by evil in ways they cannot escape on their own. Right?
And that's why they bought into
truth.
That. Exactly.
As a result, every utopian scheme identifies an erroneous source for the obvious darkness in the world. And I talked about that early. Mm-hmm. Instead of looking inside the individual human heart, remember G.K. Chesterton was asked what's wrong with the world, and he said
I am.
He could have said a whole bunch of other things, you
That's
know?
Right.
Right? But instead he said, I am. The utopians do not look at the individual human heart. They look outward. And they, you know, if you're a Marxist, it's the aristocracy or the reactionaries or the bourgeoisie. If you're a National Socialist in Germany, then it's the Jews or the liberals or the inferior race. voices. If you're a feminist, it's the upholders of patriarchy or the white hegemonists. If you're in the gay lobby, then it's the homophobes. Or if you're in the population movement, the overpopulators. I mean, there's always a demon.
Mm-hmm.
Some group of people that's going to become demonized. Whoever the targeted group happens to be, they are seen to have placed themselves athwart progress. Meaning, if we could just get rid of them, then everything will be fine. I mean, look what happened in the French Revolution.
The target's coming upon us, upon Christians.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Look what happened in the French Revolution. Look mm-hmm. what happened in the Russian Revolution.
Well, and after the French Revolution, they went around and killed all the priests.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, not after, during, and in before. And in the Russian Revolution, they just did away with a whole class of people.
That's right.
Altogether. So, you know, I guess the point is this. If we can just identify, that's what humans think a lot of the times. If we could just identify the culprits, we'll just get away with that, and then everything will be fine.
Mm-hmm. Instead of looking inside, they're looking outside.
That's right. So, and that's a temptation, isn't it? You know, even look, you know, at the way that whole social classes were done away with during the French Revolution, whole groups. That was evil, but at the time, it felt evil, I'm sure, but the people who were doing it felt that they were doing the right thing. At the time of Hitler and the Jews, I don't see how many people could have rationalized doing away with ethnic cleansing. I can't imagine, but there were probably people who didn't want to know because they saw the results.
They were in great denial.
Because the economy was good, you know, mm-hmm. see? Mm-hmm. A lot of good Germans, a lot of good people just did not see or did not want to see what was going on because, hey, we're the top economy in the world. Everything's going fine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is that tendency that if we are fine, if our society is fine, if our family is fine, if our group is fine, sorry about your loss about the rest of the world.
But that's the end justifies the means.
Exactly. So the idea is modern utopians are the great mass murderers of history, and the death toll continues to mount. I like how they say that, mm-hmm. you know, religious wars caused mass killings, but really the ones that have caused the worst mass killings in history have been the ethnic cleansers, have been the National Socialists, and have been the communists, you know, the people who do not predicate any religious belief of any kind. So that's a very interesting contradiction. We should not be surprised at this because if those who had no medical knowledge confidently stepped forward and began operating on people's brains, the likely result would be serious harm. Because basically exactly. what he's saying is they didn't know what they were doing.
Exactly.
They thought they knew what they were doing. They thought they were educated to solve the world's problems, but they didn't have the answer. And the answer was Jesus Christ. But first, in order, you know, as I've heard say, until we can understand that we need salvation and that we are in dire trouble and we are in bondage to sin and death, the good news is going to seem like no news.
That's right.
Until we understand the bad news, the good news is going to seem like no news.
That's right.
And that's kind of the main thing that he says. We need to figure out what the bad news is in order to understand what the good news. There is our rebellion. There is our original sin. We have, because as a result, a fatal tendency towards evil in the daily matters of life. By our sin, we have delivered ourselves into the power of the enemy of the human race, the angelic being who had rebelled against God in his envy of the high destiny of humanity. Also, there was the whole of human society meant for good, but now dominated by sinful humans under the influence of darkness and tending to enshrine pride, injustice, violence, greed, and lust as its working principles. The classic Christian expression of the state of things is called the world, the flesh, and the devil. And
exactly.
that is who holds sway. When we come back next time, we hope to conclude this whole idea of leadership based on utopian ideals is never going to lead us anyway. It can only be a leadership based on the Judeo-Christian ideals, and specifically the ideal of Christ the King, Christ the leader, who is all in all. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.